Welcome to the Irish Tech News Podcast, where we will bring you some of the most interesting interviews and features from the world of tech. Visit irishtechnews.ie and check out our podcast section to explore all of our previous episodes. You can subscribe to our podcast using whatever your favorite app or service is by visiting anchor.fm/irish-tech-news.
Hello, everybody. Welcome to the Irish Tech News Podcast. This is your host, Jamil Hassan, a.k.a. Crypto Hipster, where I interview founders, entrepreneurs, and thought leaders in crypto and blockchain globally. And today, I have a very interesting guest. His name is Howard Krieger. He is the founder of Unfederal Reserve. Howard, welcome.
Hey, thank you for having me, Jamil.
Oh, you're very welcome. My first question to kick things off is, what is your background, and is it a logical background for what you're doing now?
So great question, Jamil. I spent the first 10 years out of college working in consumer and commercial banking with HSBC and Wells Fargo, two of the top 10 banks at the time in the United States. Specifically, I was brought in to initially build a pricing model for HSBC consumer debt, which is kind of like making vegetable soup. You have to learn a little bit about risk. You have to learn a little bit about behavior and costs and put all that together and come up with, hey, what is the appropriate rate to charge for the risk undertaken? From there, I developed a real interest in structured finance and securitization and how the big players move money around and what the triggers are for them to move money around. And that led into the last 10 years where I was working with KPMG. It's a big four accounting firm in the United States as their national leader in financial services valuation, which meant that I would work with entities like, say, Capital One when they purchased ING Bank, figuring out, hey, what do you pay for a bank? Or working with the Pension Benefit Guarantee Corporation, the PBGC, which is the quasi-government entity responsible for all non-government pension calculation and disbursement. And so in there, you have all sorts of interesting financial vehicles and structures. And really, what I developed an interest in is the way the triggers that cause folks to borrow money and the risks considered in paying it back and what have you. And about 3 years ago, a partner of mine, a friend of mine at the time, said, hey, everyone is looking at Bitcoin as something that can be used as collateral. And so we went ahead and started a residual token, really with the intent to be a fiat for crypto lender. And we found very early on, you can't make a fiat, meaning like a US dollar, that's a type of fiat currency, for a crypto loan without the rate being so high that you really wouldn't want the borrower that would accept that loan, because the cost would be too much for a borrower to not just go with another alternative, like taking a personal loan out. And the only way, and this is the players that do this today, like a BlockFi or a Nexo, the only way that you can make an affordable crypto for fiat loan is if you gamble with the borrower's collateral. And frankly, we weren't going to do that. So we spent the subsequent 18 months trying to figure out ways to say, okay, well, if we still want to focus on consumer lending, maybe if we work directly with exchanges, maybe if we try to find some other efficiencies through white labeling other customer solutions, we could make crypto for fiat loans affordable. And the whole time we were doing this, DeFi started to really catch fire. We had read Dharma's initial paper. We'd been following the work of Compound. And it was about, 6-7 months ago that we said, you know what? Let's do two things. One, let's get out of the direct-to-consumer space and focus on business-to-business lending because it's a different animal. It's a different level of, say, expectation and rules and regulation. And we said, let's focus on DeFi. Instead of trying to make crypto loans fit in a traditional lending framework, let's see if we can take DeFi and make DeFi something that's enterprise or institutional ready.
That's a good move. I think I have some follow-ups in that. Well, my first question is going to be this, and then I have a couple of follow-ups already after what you said. Thank you. What is Unfederal Reserve? How does it all work? How does the specifics work of you being an institutional player in DeFi?
So Unfederal Reserve is a banking product software company. Right now, and a lot of folks don't know this, and I can really only speak to the U.S. market, but I think the trend holds true globally. Challenger banks, meaning in the United States, let's say banks with under $20 billion in assets, typically don't have their own software stack. In essence, there are software companies that have programmed everything from accepting deposits to like processing snapshots of checks, like when you take a picture with your phone, to doing tax forms. All of that has been developed by independent software companies. And these banks, in essence, license that software to run the bank while the bank focuses on getting customers. So Unfederal Reserve is looking to make banking applications using DeFi protocols for the benefit of those software companies that want to, you know, offer that to their banks, or to the banks themselves that want to offer a new, faster, more secure product to their lineup for their existing customer base. So Unfederal Reserve is focused on building banking products using DeFi protocols as their base code, and then going expanding from there.
So you mentioned business to business instead of direct to consumer. And direct to consumer, I think we all learned in the past few weeks, at least I did, what the real value, how total value locked actually works. Use the same approach of total value locked and targeting a certain collateral margin percentage, or do you work differently?
Sure. So we had a really great product launch about 2 weeks ago for our initial phase one product, Reserve Lending, which is a simple fork of Compound, a few tweaks here and there. But it is a fork of Compound, which is a consumer to consumer. I think of it as like a peer to pool to peer sort of lending framework. For the B2B product, we're going to start with that Compound protocol and the lessons we learned from launching Reserve Lending. And we're going to, you know, crack that logic and change certain terms and conditions to work with similar efficiency in the B2B space. So for instance, our first commercial product, which we intend to launch in Q4, will be Reserve B2B. And that will be an uncollateralized lending platform where, in essence, you have a curated safe harbor, meaning the only folks that can attach to Reserve B2B will be KYC, meaning know your customer, and AML, meaning anti-money laundering, and BSA, Bank Secrecy Act, compliant entities. And it's those entities that are KYC, AML, and BSA compliant that will contribute to the pool of capital that the borrowers would then extract. The rationale for the contribution to the pool is that these institutions can earn in a high yield money market a higher rate of interest than what they're earning today, which is nothing. So they can earn, say, half a percentage point or a third of a percentage point on a high yield deposit account. And on the borrow side, they can borrow unsecured, but pay, you know, a point or two less than what they're paying today, as they are currently somewhat held hostage to the banking relationships they currently have. And the reason we can do this, have this unsecured lending be a possibility, is because the amount of the amount of borrowing that these institutions can do, the size of their credit line will be proportionate to their overall capital structure. And there's no way in heck an entity is going to risk its entire balance sheet by defaulting on what is going to be a relatively nominal loan, versus their business. But that's, there is price for that event. Anyway, we just think that there's really no incentive for the institutions to use our platform in that manner once it goes live.
Got it. So my next question is this: how has the advent of crypto lending and DeFi impacted the traditional financial players?
So for now, it's still largely off the radar, even among financial professionals, and it's become more prevalent. But among finance professionals, when I go to conferences or Zoom conferences, right, or speak with folks, the general appetite of crypto for traditional finance is still very uncertain. They don't understand it. They don't need to understand it. They don't want to understand it. Anything that challenges paradigms can be very difficult psychologically for people in traditional finance or in any walk of life to really grasp and take hold of. I will say that one of the more, say, exciting things about blockchain technology in general is really two things: the speed and the security. That the wires and the pipes that DeFi or blockchain tech runs on more generally it's not as efficient as, say, some certain database software. Blockchain is a very inefficient database, but the immutable record keeping and the speed of it is something that most financial services platforms will need to start exploring this year or next latest. I think a real implementation of blockchain or crypto solutions, falls back on that adage. People underestimate progress in 10-year increments and they overestimate in 2-year increments. So I'm going to risk the 2-year here and say that in all likelihood, by 2025, probably half of the banking products that folks use with day-to-day will have some sort of blockchain underpinning, either as an audit on traditional rails or as replacing or as a new product altogether. So I'm going to give it like 4 years for about half of banking products to use blockchain rails in some way.
That makes sense. Actually, some of the cryptos I have been trading 2 years ago have 10x in 2 years. Now, what trends are you seeing and what opportunities haven't been explored yet? And then I got to follow up from there too.
Yeah, sure, certainly. The trends are across the board. I mean, it really from a blockchain perspective, it's really exciting to see, companies like MyBlock working with human capital and the use of blockchain. Our competitors, right, in the DeFi space, also looking to make headway into traditional finance. Like Aave just created like a private login area. Other aspects: data and record keeping, real estate records, seeing real world assets like what Centrifuge is doing with Maker on using DeFi to fund structured products. I mean, that's the kind of stuff that excites me. I guess the reality is that it kind of depends what you're into as to what trends you think are exciting. I will say though that I don't know of an industry at this point where some aspect of blockchain hasn't already started to look for ways to be a solution. So a lot of exciting stuff in cross-border currency transactions, traditional banking, payment settlement, real estate, you name it, all amazing things.
Great. Now, what if these traditional players, or anybody really, PMs, VCs, whatever, banks, could attach a rate of return for a risk to each crypto? What would that look like? What would be the benefit of that?
Well, you know, the system is, and again, I can speak only to the US, you know, US markets. And again, I'm not a regulatory expert in any way, shape, or form. I'm as much a passenger in regards to regulations and compliance as anybody else. You know, I think everybody at the end of the day just tries to figure out what is the spirit and intent of the rules. And I know personally, on Federal Reserve, you know, we live by five core principles: safety, courtesy, inclusion, courtesy, and show. And all of our decisions, even when it comes to regulatory decisions, we try to make those in the context of those five keys. You know, when you go back through history and you look at why securities regulations are the way they are, they exist, in fact, to protect the public from predatory actions by folks. The idea that, I mean, you see it today, not in finance per se, but, you know, if you watch like commercials during prime time and they're advertising, you know, toys or prescription medication, what all that marketing and advertising is trying to get you to do is they're trying to convince you that the benefit that you get from the thing, the toy, the prescription pharma, the meal out, that the benefit that you obtain from that object or service will outweigh the cost that you incur to buy the pill, get the toy, go to the restaurant, tour the location. And the for the most part, consumers can make a judgment call, right? Either I feel like having a hamburger or I don't feel like having a hamburger. No amount of flash and razzle dazzle on a television is really going to change whether or not you're hungry, per se. The challenge when it comes to finance and projects is if you are telling someone, look, if you spend X, you're going to get something greater later. And all of that is predicated on a series of unknowns that are within and without the control of the people running the project. The consumer can't discern those things easily. You know, even experts have a challenge of understanding what influences and controls folks have over the ability to generate returns. So I kind of stand by a lot of the logic there that says, hey, look, if you're going to go out and you're going to try to raise money by selling, you know, fractions of an idea, it should really be done in a regulatory and a regulatory compliant and controlled manner. I think one of the benefits of our project is that, you know, we aren't, our token ERSDL is not a security. It is essentially a license to participate in the development of the project itself. You know, we rely on surveys, community feedback. We recently had an outing with members where we solicited actively information from them. The idea being that, look, we want the community to build this thing. We know, we have a good idea of what the need is, but we want to bring in eyeballs and experience both in traditional finance and in the new world of crypto finance and DeFi, bring those two worlds together, have them by Congress and committee develop a solution which the world is waiting for. And so that, living by that utility, means that that, you know, we can sleep at night because we know that what we're offering is an opportunity for folks to participate, and not something where there's a promise of future gain. It's really about being an active member of the community. And then down the road, when we have institutions using the platform, our token is then used to represent the licensing fee being paid to use our software product. Like I mentioned before, the small banks have to pay a licensing fee for the software companies. We're no different. We're a software company. The licensing fee comes from our institutional borrowers. It's a pass-through. We use it to then aggregate our token out of the marketplace. And it's yet to be decided what we do with it. Once we aggregate it back, that's going to be for the community to decide.
Got it. That's great. You know, I see DeFi only growing. And so I think so do you. You know, and in a few years from now, DeFi will be major. What do banks need to do, or what do banks need to do right now, so they're not playing catch up in a few years? What do they got to do to?
Well, I can tell you what I hear they are doing. So the first thing that they're looking after is they're trying to create a lot of them, the challenger banks. These are kind of like the tech forward challenger banks. Fintechs are almost all unilaterally looking to make their own stablecoin. You know, there's a lot of, Signature Bank with their Signet product. I know Cross River Bank is thinking about making a stable coin that should be coming out soon. I imagine the JPMorgan Chases of the world and their token, they're going to look to convert into like this dollar for dollar. You know, if they receive a deposit, they mint, and when the dollar goes out, they burn. This whole proxy for a U.S. dollar is really a target for a lot of these early banks. And it's going to be interesting to see which stablecoin really takes hold. I like Avanti's, the first crypto chartered bank out of Wyoming, Avanti. Their crypto stablecoin, I believe they're looking to have it receive banknote status, which would actually make the token FDIC insured if it was approved, which in essence is now you literally don't need that dollar because you have a federally guaranteed banknote version of a stablecoin. Just brilliant. So I would think for banks that are thinking that, hey, they got to do something, the first thing is just appoint somebody to participate in the ecosystem. You have someone in the bank get an ERC-20 wallet and open accounts at the top DeFi exchanges, hopefully ours, and then go from there. Learning about what DeFi means, what the limits are, what the controls are. And then like us, our biggest competitive advantage versus Aave or any of these other DeFi platforms is we're focused on US regulatory and compliance rails. So the bank that wants to be in crypto should also be thinking about, hey, what are my rules and regs? And where am I getting the data to meet those rules and regs today, and how can DeFi map to that data so that maybe I need a hybrid, traditional centralized database for something, and then DeFi for the maybe the engine of the deposits and lending. But the combination of the centralized data and the blockchain data, how does that map to my US regulatory and compliant needs? Those should be the steps that these banks take over the next 9 months. Maybe not dive right into like, let's make a new stable coin. But those are the two kind of main areas right now.
Great. So say stable coins don't take off, right? So then you end up with, Federal Reserve, the actual Federal Reserve versus Bitcoin, I guess. How has the Federal Reserve and how would it be impacted? You mentioned rules and regulations, right? So you got CCAR regulations in the U.S. You have the rules that the traditional banks are bound by. How could Bitcoin and other cryptos impact the Federal Reserve's rules for CCAR and regulations of regular banks?
Sure. So first off, the Federal Reserve provides a necessary function in the U.S. economy, and I would think central banks in general I'm kind of a Hamiltonian with respect to that, that I think a central bank does provide a lot of necessary functions, stabilizing currency, attempting to provide governors on inflation, you're providing a discount window to the chartered institutions themselves. I'll caveat that by saying that the smaller ones I know are challenged to take advantage of those discount windows. And in fact, a lot of smaller banks basically bank with bigger banks so that the bigger banks can deal with the tasks and procedures and policies of the Fed itself. So I think that a lot like Darwin's finches on the Galapagos, at various scales, you have necessary players. And I think at the largest scales, central banks working with each other across different country jurisdictions provides a necessary service. And it also provides a necessary service to those large banks. I do see, though, that with the advent of Bitcoin and other cryptocurrencies, what you're seeing is if I can kind of bastardize Adam Smith a little bit, a collapsing of work and the rent. So, a lot of his philosophy has to do with the fact that, we pay various rents for things. And in his case, he wasn't just talking about room and board. He was also talking about labor. And with the challenge has always been, how do you take a field of wheat, translate it to a value in the form of a precious rock or marked material, and then have that value remain constant? You can't carry the wheat bales with you, they go bad, but the value of wheat moves up and down, the value of other goods moves up and down. And if you move the value store away from the value creation, you get this disconnect that puts a risk into the currency holder that they never intended. And so I think one of the issues is going to be for the Fed and other governments and other regulators is, how much line do you let out? Do you let the fisher person who catches the fish at the dock and then receives a crypto token for that fish so that they can buy bait at the bait shop and gas at the marina store to then go buy fish to then get crypto? And you can have these kind of micro ecosystems that run off their own currency without the challenge of the fisherman catching a fish, translating it to dollars, hope the price of gas doesn't increase tremendously or bait increase tremendously relative to the currency, where they could have been in a crypto token that would have served all the needs of that ecosystem without being subject to the same fluctuations in value. That's going to be the question for these central governments, is how much do you let work and the currency, the store of value for that work, exist in these micro ecosystems? Obviously, for taxation purposes and other bookkeeping purposes, the government wants to be able to see all that stuff. But the question is do they let those micro economies exist, or do they force themselves in and say, no, you can only buy gas using US dollars as opposed to using some sort of crypto? Those problems are going to be unfolding over the next decade or two. It'll be interesting to see how it works out.
Fascinating. I'm very interested to see too. So I want to thank you for your time today. It's been an interesting conversation. I've learned a lot. So my last question is, for people who want to find out more information about you, about On Federal Reserve, about your company, how can they do that?
Yeah, certainly. Well, first stop is, unfederalreserve.com. We have a nice blurb and write up, and you can read about the team of, consisting of folks with over 200 years of consumer and commercial lending and regulatory and compliance and crypto technology. We just have a really, really sharp group of people tackling these real world finance problems, and going to that website's a really great stop. The other thing too is you can look me up on LinkedIn, Howard Krieger. You can see my resume and background there for, for you to all enjoy and comment on. And again, we have some robust communities on Discord and Telegram, and I encourage folks to check those out and ask other folks. Rather than ask me directly on what I think, because I'm always going to be incredibly optimistic and happy about the way things are going. Ask the other people in the community how they feel about their participation in the project, and I expect that they're going to have some really positive things to say too.
Great, awesome. Thank you very much for your time today.
Hey, you too, Jamil. Thank you so much. And thank you, everybody, for listening.
Thank you for listening to the latest Irish Tech News podcast. Check back every day for the latest episode. You can follow us on Twitter at Irish_Tech News, on Facebook, facebook.com/Irish Tech News, on LinkedIn, linkedin.com/company/Irish-Tech-News, on Instagram, instagram.com/IrishTechNews.ie, and on TikTok, tiktok.com/@IrishTechNews.